From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. An historic interim deal with Iran is going into effect today, easing some economic sanctions in exchange for international inspections, and Iran easing back on its nuclear program. A chance for real engagement, the Obama administration says, for a real long-term nuclear deal down the road. Many in the U.S. Congress aren't so sure. A bill making the rounds on Capitol Hill would crank up the pressure on Iran, raise more sanctions, more demands. The White House says it's a deal killer and maybe the path to war. This hour on Point, the battle at home over Iran. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you support trying the waters with Tehran, the interim deal, or a tougher stance? Is that the path to war? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. A very warm welcome to our new listeners in Abilene, Texas today on 89.7 KACU. We and On Point listeners all over the country welcome you to the conversation. With me first today from Washington is Robin Wright, a journalist, author, distinguished scholar at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson Center, longtime observer of Iran. She just returned from Iran, has written a big piece in the current issue of Time magazine headlined A New Beginning in Tehran. You can read it at our website, onpointradio.org. Robin Wright, welcome back to On Point.
Always great to be with you, Tom.
So as we speak, this interim agreement is kicking in, we're told, in Iran. If all goes to plan, Robin, what is happening today? The beginning of what?
Well, this is a phased process that will take place over the next 6 months as the world's six major powers and Iran try to make a short-term deal into something that is enduring. The question, of course, is for how long and under what terms? But for now, the Iranians are beginning to convert some of their more highly enriched uranium in basically making it into less enriched uranium. It's converting the process. The IAEA, the UN Nuclear Watchdog Agency, has issued a report saying that Iran is taking these first steps. This is a process, though, that, as I said, will play out over 6 months. And in exchange, the Iranians are getting some modest sanctions relief, about $4.2 billion in revenues that they've already earned but have been unable to get access to because they've been in banks that are prohibited from doing business with Iran, and a little bit more in terms of goods and commodities.
Meanwhile, in Washington, there is this kind of battle on, and the White House pushing very hard on this, and some in Congress pushing very hard back. There are those who want to raise more sanctions. The White House has said that would put us, would trigger a march toward war. Said this anonymous National Security Council staffer has been widely quoted saying that if some members of Congress want military action against Iran, they should be upfront with the American public and say so. Is Tehran very aware of this parallel effort in Washington, Robin? And you're just back. What are they saying about this effort to hold more sanctions over Iran?
Well, I talked to both the Iranian foreign minister, who is the chief nuclear negotiator, as well as other key members of the regime, including the chairman of the National Security Committee at the parliament. And they were all very adamant that if the United States imposes new sanctions, then diplomacy is dead, because the deal stipulates there will be no new sanctions.
And you mean the interim deal, the one going into effect today, that's part of it?
That's correct, that Iran will not face any additional sanctions. Now, the move by the Senate, which is now supported by 59 co-sponsors, including both Republicans and Democrats, says that Iran, that the sanctions may not go into effect for 6 months. But it also has a number of other stipulations in it, including things about supporting Israel if it should attack, throwing in other issues that are not part of this nuclear deal, such as Iran's support for extremist groups. The administration has said the nuclear deal is a first step, and they hope it will be the first step of others, that this is a tough process and that the Senate basically is removing the one peaceful means of ensuring that Iran does not produce the world's deadliest weapon, and that short of the diplomatic option, the only thing left on the table is the military option. And the White House has argued that this amounts to a war resolution. Now, it's quite interesting that since the Iran and the six major powers agreed to the implementation date today, some of the momentum behind this bill has dissipated. There is a sense that maybe now is not the right time. It's not likely to be taken off the table, but it may not face a vote anytime soon.
The president lobbying very hard with Democrats at the White House on that just last week. I mean, it may be simmering down a little bit, but clearly there's been a hard push to be tougher here. You're just back from Tehran, Robin. What's the sort of array of political forces there, those open to perhaps a change here, and those in Iran who would like to take a harder line, maybe even now?
Well, there is a serious debate in Iran. But the interesting thing is that the idea of repairing relations, maybe not restoring immediately, but repairing relations gradually with the United States, is now widely accepted by a lot of people, including some of the hardline clerics who once supported President Ahmadinejad, who is notorious for his hardline rhetoric. I was actually allowed for the first time in the American embassy, which I've been trying to do for 33 years.
The one taken over in 1979, where American diplomats were held for 400-plus days.
That's right. 52 Americans held 444 days. And I covered that moment in history. I was stood at the foot of the steps of the plane in Algeria when they flew to freedom. And so I have been personally invested in this particular moment, and that has defined U.S.-Iran relations ever since. And this time I was allowed in. And I also went to see the mastermind of the hostage taking. He was one of three young students who came up with the idea. And he is now all for restoring relations with the United States and reopening the U.S. embassy. So there is a mood shift among some of the important or well-known political names in Iran. At the same time, there are those hardline factions who don't trust the United States, who believe that our intentions are no better than they were in 1953 when the U.S. supported, in fact, organized, orchestrated a coup against the first democratically elected prime minister and helped restore the last Shah to the throne. And there's a sense that the United States really is trying to, you know, regain control over Iran or its influence over Iran or determine its policies. And so there's that underlying suspicion that we see reflected in both capitals, both Washington and Tehran, that's still there.
What about the underlying suspicion in Washington, Robin, that all of this potential rapprochement here, this repairing, as you call it, I mean, to simplify it, I think the one view in Washington is it's all a kind of elaborate propaganda dance to yet again divert focus from a long-term determination to get nuclear weapons in Iran.
Well, clearly there are 59 senators who believe that, and I think there are a lot of Americans. Even the president has said the chances of doing a long-term deal are only 50-50 at best. So there is that underlying suspicion that Iran is trying to buy time. At the same time, if it does roll back some of its capabilities, if it does, in over the next 6 months, help build confidence, I think there is the potential, I didn't say possibility, but there is the potential for preventing another Middle East war. And I think that's really what the White House wants. And I think that's probably where American public sentiment is, according to most of the polls. So needless to say, there are a lot of suspicions about what Iran has done. It has capabilities that exceed just a peaceful nuclear energy program. But we also have seen in Iran a political transition with the election of a new president last summer and his outreach on issues that exceed, the nuclear deal. And the reality in Iran that they have suffered from sanctions and that they really want to move on and deal with some of the bigger issues, whether it's regional instability, the growing sectarian violence that affects Iran as the world's largest Shiite country. And there are a lot of other issues that play into this nuclear deal and have led, I think, to what is a strategic recalculation or recalibration about where their long-term interests lie. And 10 years ago, we talked about the Shiite crescent stretching from Tehran into Baghdad, into Damascus and Beirut. And now, in stark contrast, you see the rise of Sunni extremists. And Iran finds itself with the withdrawal of American troops, facing al-Qaeda franchises in on the rise in Iraq and Syria, and Sunni Salafi, these militant groups, truly fundamentalist and wanting to take the region back to the ways of life in the 7th century, that are evident in most countries surrounding Iran. So there is, you know, a bigger picture here into which this nuclear deal plays.
Robin, we just got half a minute before the break. We'll expand this circle. Judging intention is very difficult. You're just back from Iran. What do you say to those in Washington who say, let's try this interim deal? What do you say to those who say, don't trust it, let's push harder?
Well, when you look at the stark alternatives, diplomacy or war, it's clearly diplomacy is far more appealing. And I do think that the Iranians want to see if they can do a deal. The key question is going to be enrichment and whether Iran has the right to enrich. And that's where you are likely to find the next 6 months play out over that one issue.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the interim deal with Iran on nuclear enrichment, in effect today, and the push on Capitol Hill for more sanctions, which the White House says could well be a path to war. Robin Wright has joined us from Washington. A big story in the current issue of Time magazine from her very recent reporting visit to Iran. She's just back there in Iran today. Iranian state-sponsored English language press TV. The country is saying the country had announced complete suspension of 20% enriched uranium in its nuclear sites, a major part of the interim agreement. Here's that.
The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says the country voluntarily halts the production of 20% enriched uranium as of today. The suspension comes on the first day of the implementation of the Geneva deal between Iran and the five permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany.
In Washington and beyond, there have been very prominent people not buying it. In November, in the middle of the Geneva talks, just wrapped up successfully on the interim agreement 8 days ago, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the proposed interim deal on Iran's nuclear program was very bad.
So Iran got the deal of the century, and the international community got a bad deal. This is a very bad deal. Israel utterly rejects it.
There are plenty in Washington who would agree, maybe even a veto-proof majority in the Senate, though some of the steam may be off that right now. On Thursday last week, the White House pushing very hard last week to keep this thing together as it moved toward implementation. Press Secretary Jay Carney said Congress should not be now considering new sanctions against Iran. Here's Carney.
Now is not the time to pass a new sanctions measure because it might have the inadvertent consequence of weakening the sanctions regime and reducing the president's flexibility when it comes to pursuing a potential peaceful resolution to the Iranian nuclear program.
Right there last week from the White House, Carney speaking. With us right now from Windham, New York, is Peter Beiner, contributing editor at the Atlantic National Journal, associate professor of journalism at the City University of New York, senior columnist at Haaretz.com. Peter Beiner, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And from Washington, Mark Dubowitz joins us, executive director of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, co-chair of the Project on U.S. Middle East Nonproliferation Strategy. Mark Dubowitz, welcome to you as well.
Hi, Tom. Pleased to be here.
Peter Beiner, do you think that the threat, if as the White House sees it, of this legislation that would bring more sanctions to bear or threaten them is dissipating, as the White House persuaded those 59 senators and maybe more to back off?
Well, in a sense, from the most real politic point of view, they only have to persuade one senator, and that's Harry Reid, because it would require Harry Reid to bring this to a vote. It could have gone through the Senate Banking Committee, where Tim Johnson, who supports the White House on this, will not bring it to the floor. And so Reid has to be willing to bring it to the floor. And so far, he doesn't seem to be willing to do that, and I think that may well be because there are a significant number of Democrats, even Democrats who have signed on to the legislation, who themselves are not so keen to have a vote on this sanctions legislation right now. So right now, it doesn't look like a vote is imminent on the sanctions deal.
Mark Dubowitz, is the bill dead? Is it a dead letter, or what do you see?
No, Tom, I don't think so. I mean, you've got about 59 co-sponsors, but you've got probably over 70 senators in whip counts who've said that they would vote for this bill. So you probably already have a veto-proof majority. I think the Senate is going to give the administration a little bit of time after the State of the Union, see how things play out. But there is strong bipartisan commitment and deep bipartisan commitment to using sanctions as a way to increase American leverage at the negotiating table.
Robert Menendez, Democrat, New Jersey, has been right in the middle of that push. In November, he told ABC's George Stephanopoulos that he thought keeping sanctions in place would be important going forward. Here's Menendez.
I think that the possibility of moving ahead with new sanctions, including wording it in such a way that if there is a deal that is acceptable, that those sanctions could cease upon such a deal, is possible. It's an insurance. It's an insurance for the United States to make sure that Iran actually complies with an agreement that we would want to see.
But last week, testifying before the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Secretary of State John Kerry saying, don't do this.
We have told them there will not be new sanctions of any kind imposed while we are negotiating. So if Congress votes for new sanctions, Congress is going off on its own. And it raises a question. Most importantly, I'm not as worried about, you know, how they interpret it as I am worried about how our allies, our friends, our partners interpret it. They're part of this.
John Kerry just last week. Peter Beinart, what do you see then going on here? And do you see the threat of a path to war?
Yes, I do. I think that we don't know whether these diplomatic negotiations will succeed in the best of circumstances, but I think it's pretty clear to most experts who've looked at this that passing this Iran sanctions bill would make that harder, not easier. First of all, the Iranian foreign minister already said, as many have quoted, that he would interpret even deferred sanctions as violating the interim agreement. And it is the Iranian interpretation of that interim agreement which is very significant in whether, in fact, this Iran sanctions bill is going to help or hurt the diplomatic process. I think John Kerry is also absolutely right that some of our allies would interpret it as an American violation of the interim agreement. Beyond that, if you look at the specifics of the legislation itself, it would make a final agreement almost impossible. According to some interpretations, it would prevent Iran from enriching any uranium, even though the United States' Obama administration has already said we can accept a certain amount of enriched uranium by Iran under tight inspection. Mm-hmm. And it conditions a final agreement on issues that were never contemplated to be part of the nuclear deal, like Iran's relationship with Hezbollah, for instance, or Iran's missile tests. Issues where America may have real legitimate concerns, but are not part of this nuclear negotiation. So yes, I think it makes the path to a nuclear deal much harder, and therefore it makes the chances of war more likely.
Mark Dubowitz, do you support passage of the bill? And if so, explain why. Why raise the stakes now?
Well, Tom, I know Peter hasn't been close to the congressional discussions over the legislative language, but I think it's very important to understand the actual details. First of all, the legislation itself was carefully crafted in a bipartisan way, so it actually provides specific discretion. It provides enough room for interpretation for the Obama administration to certify that a limited enrichment program would be permissible, and I know the White House believes they can certify that. The second issue is that it is not the Geneva Agreement doesn't prohibit all sanctions. It prohibits the imposition of no new nuclear sanctions. So certainly the administration is free to impose terrorism-related sanctions or human rights sanctions. And it's very clear, as Senator Menendez said, they are not imposing new sanctions. This is a sanctions-in-waiting bill. And what they're doing is that as long as Iran negotiates in good faith during the months ahead, there will be no new nuclear sanctions. The president and Secretary Kerry have repeatedly said that the United States would reimpose sanctions on Iran should Iran violate the terms of the interim agreement or fail to reach a final agreement within 12 months. So this is exactly what the legislation says and would do.
But the bill asks for more than the interim agreement imagines. Why raise the stakes now, Mark?
Well, it doesn't go beyond what the interim agreement says. I mean, we've got to be very specific about this. First of all, The legislation says that if Iran launches terrorist attacks against America or American interests, then that would be a violation of the interim agreement. I don't think the president or Secretary Kerry believe that they can continue diplomacy if Iran or Iranian-backed Hezbollah launches terrorist attacks.
I thought the language
Americans.
Was broader than that, unless it's been changed since I last looked, that it was Iran's entire, any association with what might be deemed terrorist groups.
Well, it's not terrorist groups, it's terrorist actions. So if Iran, if Hezbollah is found to be killing Americans, everybody knows that Iran controls and directs Hezbollah. And I think it would be very difficult for any president or secretary of state to continue negotiations. So I think it's very important to understand what's in the language, and the devil's always in the details. And I think that Senator Menendez and other Senate Democrats and Republicans believe they've been vindicated over the past few years. I mean, they are the ones who've passed the toughest sanctions. They're sanctions the administration objected to. They're sanctions that worked, that the administration then acknowledged and embraced. And they're sanctions that got the Iranians to the table. So I think they feel vindicated. They feel that pressure has worked. They feel it's very important to give the United States leverage. And they're very concerned that the significant sanctions relief that will flow to Iran over the next 6 to 12 months and the loopholes in the interim agreement that give Iran the ability to put nuclear facts on the ground will enhance Iranian nuclear negotiating leverage and make it much more difficult to conclude a final agreement peacefully, with the result being an Iranian nuclear weapon or the war that we're all trying to avoid.
Peter Beinart, you hear that description of the bill. Is Mark Dubowitz soft-peddling what's here? Or are you and others making more of these demands than ought be?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think for people who really want to get into the weeds, I would recommend they look at Edward Levin, who was a longtime staffer on the Senate Committee on Intelligence and Arms Control, analysis, very close analysis at the Arms Control Center, where he points out, for instance, that the language about Iranian terrorism proxy, which says Iran has not directly or through a proxy supported, financed, planned, or otherwise carried out an act of terrorism against the United States or United States persons or property anywhere in the world, is so vague, with it not even a time period specified, that it could be interpreted to refer to past Iranian actions. Mark Dubowitz said that the administration believes that it can offer a waiver about the idea that Iran has that Iran could continue to have some in nuclear enrichment program. But on AIPAC's own website, it says, AIPAC has been very involved in this, as we all know, it says that this will allow no Iranian enrichment. And the Obama administration is saying, as loud as it possibly can, this bill weakens our position at the negotiating table. It makes it harder, not strengthening us. If I could just, I think the larger point, in a way, is the point that Mark Dubowitz just made about the idea that because sanctions brought Iran to the table, therefore more sanctions will make a deal more likely. I think that the problem with that logic is that the Iranian regime is in important ways divided. The value of sanctions, of the past sanctions that have been passed, I think was primarily that it discredited Ahmadinejad and people around him and helped to produce the election result that brought in Rouhani and a group of people in Iran who have a different view and are more open to a nuclear deal and have been more open to a nuclear deal for quite a few years now. If you now, once Iran, the Iranian people have bravely gone to the polls and elected that group, you still pass more sanctions, then the message you send to the Iranians is it really doesn't matter what you do. We're still going to keep ratcheting up the pressure. And it weakens the people in Iran who we really need to be helping.
Peter, let me ask you, the headline on your Haaretz column in the Israeli newspaper column on this was, U.S. Senate sanctions bill is all about torpedoing a nuclear deal with Iran. Who would want to torpedo a deal on this front, and why, Peter?
Well, I think it's less about whether people want to torpedo a deal. I mean, there certainly are plenty of prominent hawks who've already said that diplomacy cannot succeed and that we should take military action. For instance, Bill Kristol has said that already. Cliff May, who runs Mark Dubowitz's organization, the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, has said Iran's rulers are not open to engagement no matter what mix of carrots and sticks are offered. So there are some who have already said diplomacy can't succeed. But I'm less interested in people's intentions than in the actual results of the legislation. And U.S. intelligence itself has declared that this bill would make a deal more difficult. And if we cannot get a deal, then we are faced with the choice of an Iranian nuclear weapon or potential military action. And I think I certainly believe would be two terrible choices.
Robin Wright, can you see anybody who would prefer a military solution to this to a diplomatic solution? Why?
Well, that's the hard part to figure out. And the truth is that if we wanted to impose new sanctions on Iran because of either the failure of diplomacy or because we find out that Iran is cheating, that can be done with the, you know, within 24 hours. That can be done very quickly through, whether it's through executive order or whether a congressional move. And so it's a little hard to understand how people believe that a bill that will, that is actually in violation of the spirit of diplomacy and a violation of the terms agreed to by the United States will do anything to contribute to the atmosphere that is beginning to shift in a way that makes diplomacy possible. I mean, this is the first time in, since the 1979 revolution where you've had this high-level contact, where you've had the presidents of the two countries talking to each other, where the foreign ministers are on a first-name basis. And that's really important, not just to the nuclear question, but to the broader questions about the future of the world's most volatile region. Do we want to have Iran as an enemy, not just because of the potential of war, but because of the enormous number of side effects of that, whether it's in countries where we have strategic interests, whether it's Iraq or Afghanistan, Lebanon? The future of Syria is clearly going to be a huge deal. It's what an irony that implementation goes into effect just as we're trying to deal with the crisis in Syria. And in the last 24 hours, the UN Secretary General has reached out to the Iranians and included them, at least in the opening day, which is largely ceremonial, of talks about Syria's future.
Yeah, that is some move in itself. I want to ask about that. I want to get a call or two, if I can, in before the break, Robin. Michael in Chicago is calling. Hi, Michael. You're on the air. Thanks for calling. What do you think?
Hi. I think we need to go with the deal that the president has set up right now, because that's going to be the best thing right now. It's going to help the people there. The radicals are on their way out in Iran. People are tired of not having food, money, or jobs. They need them. The administration that they have right now is going to get it for them. That's why this deal needs to be made. We can at any time destroy Iran. We know that. So I don't see a problem with doing what we're doing right now and move forward with this.
One more call right here. Spencer, West Virginia. Mike, you're on the air. What do you think, Mike?
Hi, Tom. I'm sorry to say, but I think the Republican Congress is of a Judas mentality. I think they are indeed trying to torpedo this and to actually start anything that they can to enhance the end times and the second coming of the Messiah.
Mike, you've got a bunch of Democrats who are signed on to this bill as well. It's not just Republicans.
Good point, Tom. I don't really have an answer for that, but generally speaking, with the Republican agenda, it not only reflects on the political, but the economic, and every decision, it seems like every direction they seem to be making.
Mike, we've got it. One more right here. Saeed, Green Bay, Wisconsin. Saeed, you're on the air. What do you think?
I think that there is a undue significance placed on the election of Rouhani. I think that nothing fundamental has changed in Iran. In the last 2 weeks, there have been 50 executions of prisoners of conscience in Iran. Many other facts like that tell us that nothing has changed in Iran. Iran is this is a tactical shift, not a strategic alteration of their long-term animosities.
Saeed, we'll look at that as well. And I'm sorry to run into the break here, but it's right in front of us. I appreciate your call from Green Bay. We'll pick up that perspective and more when we come back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the interim deal with Iran on nuclear enrichment, in effect today, and the push at the same time on Capitol Hill for more sanctions, which the White House says is the path to war. Robin Wright is with us. Big article from Robin in Time magazine this week. She is just back from Iran, Tehran, and beyond. She's author of Rock the Kasbah, the Iran Primer, The Islamists Are Coming, and more. You can read her latest piece in Time at our website, onpointradio.org. Peter Beinart is with us, contributing editor at the Atlantic National Journal, columnist at Haaretz.com, author of The Crisis of Zionism. And Mark Dubowitz is here, executive director of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, joins us from Washington. Last week on Fox News, Republican Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming, co-sponsor of a bill that would impose stronger sanctions on Iran or threaten them, said he's willing to allow 6 months of negotiations on Iran's nuclear program, but doubts anything good will come of it.
Anybody that trusts Iran hasn't really been paying attention for the last 30 years. They cheat, they lie, and cannot be trusted. It is sanctions, tough sanctions, that actually drove Iran to this point. And I think that relieving sanctions is a terrible mistake.
Wyoming Republican John Barrasso there. On Fox News Sunday, Senator Patrick Leahy from Vermont, chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, told Chris Wallace that imposing more sanctions on Iran right now would be a mistake.
I think if we do that, we screw up the ability to have real negotiations. If the negotiations fail, if Iran is seen cheating, we will impose more sanctions in a nanosecond. Both the House and the Senate will. Don't do it prematurely, because if you're trying to negotiate something, you don't have a third party, in this case, the Congress, coming in involved in that negotiation.
Democrat Patrick Leahy of Vermont. Mark, Peter, Robin, I want to give you just a sampling of our listeners' response here online. Here's a listener on the website who says, I hope the UN inspectors are actually allowed to go wherever they need in order to conduct inspections to verify that what Iran has agreed to is reached. Last time I checked, he says, we were still the great Satan. That language from 79 and after out of Iran. Dennis says sanctions have not changed behavior positively. It's entrenched bad feelings, caused mistrust to grow and hurt the common man. Time to try something new. And Kay writes to us here, AIPAC, the pro-Israel lobbying group in Washington, influencing our foreign policy here. As always, they want the U.S. to go to war for them. Peter, you're writing for Haaretz in Israel. What about Kay's perspective there?
I think that it's no secret that that AIPAC supports these sanctions, but it's also a mistake to see this as some kind of cabal or secret effort. It's a very public effort, and
very
I think
public.
AIPAC is doing it because the people, the leaders of AIPAC, genuinely believe it's in America's best interest. It is an American organization, and while they care deeply about Israel, I think they believe it's in America's best interest. I think that they happen to be wrong about that, and it's not in America's best interest, but I think they're doing what they think is best for the United States.
What does this bill say? If it were passed, if Israel decided it needed to attack, that the diplomacy wasn't working, what is the obligation that would be there for U.S. support?
Well, the bill says that it doesn't take away Congress's right to decision to declare war. But it also says that if Israel were to act in self-defense, whatever exactly that would mean, that America should provide, I think the phrase is, economic, diplomatic, and military support. And I think that's a mistake. I think it's a mistake while we're in the middle of negotiations to start talking about what would happen if Israel were to attack Iran. And I don't think we should make a kind of ex ante, a priori decision about what we would do if Israel were to attack until we know more about the circumstances.
I mean, yeah, and Tom, here's the problem.
One second, Mark.
It would require Israel to wait until after the diplomatic process ended.
Yes, Mark Dibowitz, please.
Yeah, Tom, here's the problem. I mean, Peter hasn't been involved closely with Congress, with the legislation, and certainly with sanctions over the past few years, and clearly is not reading the bill, because the legislation does not in any way directly or indirectly authorize the use of force. In fact, Section 405 of the bill explicitly states that nothing in the legislation may be construed as an authorization for the use of force.
But there are many uses of force that don't get authorized. It does say that the U.S. would support Israel if Israel attacks. Is that not right?
It's non-binding language. It's a sense of Congress. And by the way, it already passed the Senate 99-0 on May 22, 2013 in Senate Resolution 65. So yes, you heard that right. It passed 99-0 in May of 2013. I think what that reflects is not the power of AIPAC or the power of anybody. It reflects the fact that the majority of senators in the U.S. Congress, the majority of members of the House of Representatives, and the majority of Americans, as polls are showing us, do not trust this Iranian regime. And I find it fascinating. We've been on the phone for 45 minutes, and we haven't even brought up Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei. In fact, Saeed, the last caller, was hinting at this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he is the key decision maker. Okay, he is the man who has pursued a nuclear program, a military nuclear program, for years. He's engaged in nuclear mendacity. The current president, Rouhani, bragged about the fact that he misled the Europeans from 2003 to 2005. We're talking about a regime that has been committed to a military nuclear program. They have hundreds of outstanding questions with the IAEA on this military nuclear program that they refuse to answer. And when one of the emails that you got in asked about, will inspectors get access? Mm-hmm. Well, the inspectors are not going to get access to the military nuclear infrastructure and facilities under this Geneva Agreement. And that's actually a fundamental problem, because the 6 months that the agreement allows Iran to continue military nuclear activities, nuclear weaponization activities, ballistic missile research, in fact, everything they need for a deliverable nuclear weapon. In the meantime, this is not limited sanctions relief, as Robin has described. This, in fact, opens up significant holes in the sanctions regime. These are not just some goods. These are the lifting of petrochemical sanctions, auto sanctions, gold sanctions. The auto sector
is limited,
the second largest.
And it's not removing all sanctions, but you're saying it's substantial, it's significant, and clearly the Iranians think so.
They do. They've actually declared they think the sanctions regime is unraveling. Now, I think they're probably exaggerating, but I think that what you're seeing is already a 70% increase in trade delegations over the past few weeks. I mean, more delegations in January than all of last year. You're seeing a real hunger in the international community to get back into Iran, and you're seeing Iran's economy, which was in deep recession in 2012, which lost about 5% of GDP, is predicted by the IMF and the World Bank to be recovering by 1 to 2% growth this year. So what we're fundamentally witnessing are facts, and we can't argue with the facts, and that is that the Iranian economy is on the mend. They're increasing their economic leverage, their negotiating leverage. There's significant loopholes in the interim agreement that allow them to increase their nuclear leverage. And I think we're all on the same page. We all believe in a combination of diplomacy and pressure. And I've been a big supporter of the administration's Iran policy since 2009, and that is coercive diplomacy, of sanctions diplomacy, and the credible threat of military force.
Do you think the White House is so blind, and the State Department's so blind or foolish here? I mean, John Kerry basically begging the Senate not to do this. The White House saying the president will veto it. It could be overridden. You know, he's calling people in. He's essentially begging them not to take the step that you're encouraging here, Mark. Do you think why would they be so wrong, so off?
Well, I don't think they're blind, and I think they're dedicated to diplomacy. I think they've also got a track record of also opposing Congress on the toughest sanctions that have proven to be so effective. They opposed sanctions against Iran's central bank and oil exports in 2012. They opposed SWIFT sanctions. They opposed financial sanctions.
But there have been steep sanctions under President Obama. They're not opposed to sanctions, clearly.
Not per se, but they've actually opposed the toughest sanctions. And they opposed them, I think, for legitimate reasons at the time. They were concerned that those tough sanctions would blow up the international coalition, that they would spook oil markets, they would drive up the price of oil. They would go after a fundamental pillar of the financial system.
So why
bank.
Go
they,
in
but they
their
were
face
wrong.
Now?
Well, I think Congress's view is that the administration was wrong. And so I think Senator Menendez and Senator Kirk and what appears to be over 70 senators who've been intimately involved in these issues want to provide an insurance policy. Again, not new sanctions that become immediately implementable, but sanctions in waiting, that if the Iranians cheat over the next 6 months or if they don't conclude a final agreement within 12 months on acceptable terms, then these sanctions become implementable. And the fact of the matter is, Foreign Minister Zarif is threatening that he'll walk away from the table.
Yes, he is. To Robin Wright, just last week, yeah.
Yeah, and all of us know that if you are in a negotiation, he who is willing to walk away from the table has the upper hand. So all Zarif has to do is threaten to walk away, and everybody will scramble to keep him at the table. That enhances his negotiating leverage. So the fact is that the Iranians have already violated the spirit of Geneva. Okay, there was an Iran-Russia oil for goods deal announced 2 weeks ago, an $18 billion deal, in direct violations of U.S. sanctions. The fact is that both Iran and Russia are violating the spirit of the JPA.
Peter Beinart, an insurance policy here, if I may, Peter, an insurance policy or a torpedo?
Look, I think that you can always pass sanctions at a later date. The problem, I think, is the key word that Mark said at the end. This says there will be no problem. There won't be any new sanctions if there is an acceptable deal. Well, an acceptable deal has to be negotiated between the United States and the other Western powers and Iran. Then Congress will have a chance, presumably, to veto it. But what Congress is doing is saying a priori, this is our definition of what an acceptable deal is, and if Iran doesn't agree to that, then we're going to impose new sanctions. Well, I think that the Iran, in a negotiation, both sides have to give. Laying out your vision of an ideal deal from the American point of view and saying, unless you accept that, we're going to impose sanctions, is ultimately a way of making negotiations much harder, because in negotiations there has to be give and take on both sides.
Yeah, Robin Wright, you mentioned earlier, you referred to a potential strategic shift in Iran. Mark Dubowitz says, look at Supreme Leader Khamenei there. He hasn't shifted. His goal remains the same. Mark asserts that is a military nuclear program. What about that? Is that still the ultimate lodestar here? How will we know if that's changed? Does that have to change to find a deal, Robin?
Well, the Supreme Leader ultimately has the most powerful voice and veto power over virtually everything in Iran. But there is a sense that this is where I think with the debate in Washington often is way behind the curve of what's happening in Iran, and that suspicions and emotions and passions often overtake the facts and the kind of intellectual side of discussions and decision-making. And I think the Supreme Leader, who's long been suspicious of U.S. intentions, is even on board. And I think the Iranians, you know, we keep talking about Iran's nuclear capability. The tragic reality is that the United States and the outside world could have done a deal a decade ago when Iran had a number of centrifuges that counted in the hundreds, you know, a few hundred. And today they have over 19,000. And the reality is that they have sufficient knowledge, equipment, and know-how if they wanted to produce a bomb to make one. And the trick is now to make sure that there's no incentive, motive, or need to develop that capability. And so, you know, there are also illusions about sanctions relief. The fact is that all the sanctions laws are still in place. There's a little bit of, tiny bit of relief, but the fact is the Iranians are getting access to money that they've already earned that's just been blocked in banks, that the majority of the money they would have made with real sanctions relief, over $100 billion, they won't make back.
We're talking $4 billion here, not 100. If I may, let me go to Lisa in Lexington, Kentucky.
We're actually talking 7, not 4, but anyway.
Lisa, in Lexington, Kentucky, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay. What do you think, Lisa?
Well, as an American who has watched U.S. foreign policy fail utterly in the Middle East over the last 40 or 50 years, it's done nothing to improve the lives of people in the Middle East. It's done nothing to remove the threats that are perceived by Americans. It's about time we try and do something different. Let Obama and Kerry try a different tactic. It's not like we can't change our mind later and include more sanctions or go to war or do all the things that have failed us in the past. Let's do something different.
Give it a try, says Lisa in Lexington, Kentucky. Lisa, thank you for that. Jeff in Concord, Massachusetts. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm glad you guys touched on Israel, because I think that's the elephant that's really stomping around in the middle of the room here. And the U.S. public is sick and tired of fighting wars, losing U.S. troops, and squandering trillions of dollars to fight wars for Israel. AIPAC controls Congress. This is the only reason this is being pushed now, with bipartisan support, because the only time you see bipartisan support is when Israel is behind something. So I'd also like to remind our guests that Israel is the only country in the Middle East that has any nuclear weapons illegally, and they have hundreds of them.
What about the argument on the merits on Iran's nuclear program? I mean, what about U.S. interests in Iranian nuclear weaponization if it came to that, Jeff?
Look, Iran doesn't have how much weapons-grade nuclear fuel does Iran have? Zero. They don't have any weapons-grade nuclear fuel.
Right, but close is the issue. What do you think if they made that next step? Is it okay with you or not?
They aren't making that next step.
They haven't made it.
Of course they haven't made it. They have. We're talking about hypothetical situations. So now we're talking about spending another how many trillions of dollars for some hypothetical step?
Yeah, no, I understand the skepticism. I appreciate your call. Peter Beiner, what about U.S. and Israeli interests here, where they are parallel, where they're perhaps not?
Well, I think the important thing to remember about Israel is that the Israeli military establishment is overwhelmingly opposed to military action against Iran. Benjamin Netanyahu may be more open to it, but one of the really remarkable things that happened in Israel over the past couple of years is that the Israeli military and security leadership rose up in opposition to the idea of military action against
Iran. So why is it still in the air?
Because they felt it was bad for Israel, which is exactly the same thing that that American defense and intelligence experts have been saying, former officials, which is that military action would be ineffective and have very dangerous consequences.
So why is it still in the air, Peter? Why is the White House saying path to war?
I think there is. I think there are a number of things that's going on. I think that that for Republicans, this is clearly an opportunity to bash President Obama. I think that the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been very hostile to the interim deal to begin with, and basically sees very, very little hope for any diplomacy with Iran. And then I also do think that, and I think one can talk about this without being. Without thinking about cabals or conspiracies, but I think there is no question that groups like AIPAC and other pro-Israel groups do wield influence in Congress and have made this bill a priority and have gotten people to support it, even though I think the consensus view amongst most experts who look at this, including the American intelligence community, is that this would undermine the chances of a peaceful diplomatic agreement.
And there you have the outlines of the tension in Washington right now over the interim deal with Iran, and maybe legislation to override, or certainly add a big new angle to it. How this plays out, we'll see in the months ahead. As Mark Dubowitz says, it may be, or Robin, it may be after the State of the Union address that we hear more. When we get there, you'll have something of the background here. I want to thank all three of my guests today. Mark Dubowitz at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in Washington, thank you very much for joining us, Mark.
Thanks, Tom.
Peter Beinart at The Atlantic and National Journal. Peter, thank you to you.
Thank you.
And Robin Wright, just back from Iran, writing big for Time Magazine. Check it out. Big piece there, great piece. Robin, thank you very much for joining us today.
Always great, Tom.
Tomorrow in this hour, we're talking about net neutrality and the future of the Internet. Join us for that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.